Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi there, kids, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting directly opposite me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Let me take your picture, add it to the mixture. There it is. I got you now. Really nothing to it. Anyone can do it. It's easy, and we all know how.
Yeah, today's podcast really lends itself to that quote.
Yes. Today we wanted to talk about high-speed photography and slow motion. Both of these have to do with changing film speeds and shutter speeds and all this kind of stuff. To really talk about how this stuff works, we have to go a little bit more basic. We have to actually talk about the principles behind photography and how a camera works. And before we really get into this, How Stuff Works has dozens of great articles about photography, including articles about how high-speed photography works and how burst photography works. Both of those were written by John Fuller. But we also have how cameras work, how photographic film works. So if you want to learn more than what, you know, we're going to kind of cover the basics, but if you really want to know the true science and chemistry and physics behind how cameras work, I highly recommend you check out those articles because they will answer a lot more questions. We're going to try and kind of cover the basics here.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what a camera does. It seems kind of silly to say because most of us are really familiar with cameras. And by the way, I should point out also that we're really focusing on film.
I see what you did there.
It was completely not on purpose. We're talking about film cameras mainly in this podcast as opposed to digital. The two different methods, you know, you get a result that's similar using these two methods. You know, you get an image of a moment in time in both ways, but the actual mechanics behind film versus digital are very different. So we're specifically looking at film cameras because well, to try and cover both would require a podcast that's twice as long as what we normally do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we only do that for Google Plus.
Well, cameras in general, though, and speaking of both film and digital, mm-hmm. you're using a series of devices to capture that image. They're on both film and digital. You've got a lens.
Yes.
And there is the principle behind it is to capture the image on film. You're using a piece of essentially plastic celluloid that's treated with chemicals.
Yes.
That captures that image. And in a digital camera, you use an image sensor.
Right.
But there are some similarities. Of course, it has to do with how fast the camera is firing, and how much light you're letting in through the lens.
Right.
And after that, they do differ considerably.
Yes. Yes. So with a film camera, you know, Chris was just talking about it a second ago, but what, you know, the medium upon which you are capturing these images is film. And film is really just a strip of plastic that's been treated with chemicals that are photoreactive.
Yes.
That means that the chemicals will undergo some sort of change when exposed to light. So
they turn into monsters.
If you've listened to our if you listen to our solar panel episode, you know that we have discovered materials that react when light hits it. The photons from the light transfer energy to whatever that medium is, and you get a reaction. In this case, the photons are able to change the chemical properties of the stuff that's on this film. And to really get into that would be diving deep into science. We do have, like I said, the article on photographic film works, and that mm-hmm. explains it. But to be honest, if I were to try and go into it right now, I'm sure I would mess it up because, you know, my chemistry goes so far. My chemistry foo is weak.
Chemistry foo.
But at any rate, what this stuff is designed so that when light hits it, it has a chemical change. Then when you treat it with other chemicals, that's what allows you to create a negative image of whatever it was you were whatever light hit it. So this is why when you have film, people say, you know, make sure you don't expose it to light before or after you take a photo, because if you do, it's going to ruin the image.
Right, because the film is going to record the light from that is coming to it through the lens.
Yes.
So, of course, when you put the canister of film inside your camera and load your camera, you close the door, which blocks off any light.
Right.
And then, of course, you have to advance the film after you've taken a photo. If you've ever exposed film more than once.
Yeah, double exposure.
Yeah.
You get a really bizarre effect.
Yeah. And it can be very, very cool if that's what you're going for. It can also be really frustrating if you were trying to capture one thing in particular and forgot to advance the film.
Right. And we've even seen that double exposures go into the realm of people thinking that something supernatural is going on,
mm-hmm.
because you do get kind of a ghostly image if you double expose film. Yeah. So there have been times where people have had just a double exposure. That's all it is. But because they didn't realize it was a double exposure, they think, wow, I took this photo of my buddy Bob and there's this ghostly face that's appearing over his left shoulder. That's so creepy. And forgetting that, oh, before I took the photo of Bob, I took a photo of Liz. It's just that Bob's photo was exposed over Liz's photo, and now Liz looks like she's a ghost.
Actually, I thought it was because Bob worked at that leaky nuclear plant.
It's because we took all those photos over that Indian burial ground. That was the mistake we made. Anyway, the idea here is that the camera gives you a very controlled way to expose that film to light. And the way this works is that first you've got the lens, and the lens's purpose is to direct light to the film.
Mm-hmm.
So the lens is allowing light to pass through. When light passes through a lens, it actually – the speed of the light changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speed of light is a constant, but it's a constant that's based upon whatever the medium it is that it's traveling through.
Right. For example, air.
Yeah. Air is going to travel through light travels through air much more quickly than it will a lens. And the curvature of the lens, the thickness of the lens, that's all going to make the light travel at slightly different speeds. The point being that you focus all this light onto a point so that it exposes just the right spot on the film. Now, behind that, you've also got a device called the aperture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the aperture is essentially a hole. It's a disc that can expand or contract and allow more or less light to pass through from the lens to the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a barrier between the lens and the film, and you adjust this in order to really kind of tweak your photo settings. Like with a manual camera, a manual single lens reflex camera, or SLR, manual mm-hmm. SLR. Now, by the way, in case you're curious, for those of you who are only familiar with digital cameras, a manual single lens reflex camera is not electric at all. It uses chemicals and it uses mechanical little gears and things, but there are no electric components necessarily in a true manual single lens reflex, or at least you don't have to have any electronics.
Yeah, I think that's – yeah.
So in other words – it's kind of interesting because we take it for granted now with digital cameras, right? Digital cameras, you have lots of electronic components, but with an old manual single lens reflex, you're just turning little dials, which is advancing the film. You might have to turn a little crank to rewind film, but there's nothing necessarily electronic in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are hybrids that as well, but anyway, the aperture helps you determine how much light can enter through the lens. And then you have something else called the shutter.
Yes.
And the shutter determines how long the film is exposed to that light.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to take a photograph with a shutter speed that is it allows the shutter to be open longer, then your photo is going to be a little more blurry unless the subject of your photo is incredibly still.
Mm-hmm.
So if the camera is still and the subject is still and you've got a decent amount of lighting and the shutter is open longer, theoretically, as long as the light's not too great, you will actually get a very clear image
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because it's really capturing that moment. Now, if something's moving, then you're going to get a blur. So if you've ever looked at some nighttime photography, especially for like cityscapes where you can see where traffic is moving through and it's like beautiful red streaks on one side of the road and white streaks on the other that's obviously the traffic where cars are coming and going. That's usually using a camera with a shutter speed where the shutter's remaining open longer.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
mm-hmm.
it can be as long as, minutes or more. And that creates that streaking effect because all that light is hitting the camera over an extended time. So instead of seeing individual cars, you're seeing these streaks.
Yeah, this has – basically it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the aperture setting that you're using to expose the film, the shutter speed. And there are cameras that you can manually hold the shutter open as long as you want to. It's often better in creating the photos like Jonathan was just talking about, where you leave it open for minutes to have your camera on a tripod and use a cable release, just so that you don't nudge the camera, because otherwise you're going to jar the picture and distort things. So, yeah, it also has to do with the speed of the film. And it's funny because that's sort of a misnomer. There aren't little canisters of film moving faster than others. It has to do with the chemical properties, actually.
Look at it go!
And again, we're not going to get into the chemistry behind it so much. Depending on the speed of the film, you would be able to capture photos in darker environments or lighter environments.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the speed of the film is depending on the type of photography you're doing. If you're trying to capture high or fast motion photography, you're going to want something that you can expose to light more frequently, like a higher speed film.
Yeah.
You
want something that's going to just from a very brief exposure be able to capture an image.
Right.
And by exposure, we're talking about exposing to light. Just keep that in mind, that exposure has everything to do with the amount of light and the duration of light that hits that film. So a high speed film can capture an image with light hitting it for a shorter time frame. And we're talking fractions of a second here. You know, when we talk about a short time frame, we're talking really short. We're not talking like, oh, well, you know, 1,000, 2,000. No, you would be able to take hundreds of photos in the amount of time it took me to say that, depending on the speed of the film and the shutter speed and all of this kind of stuff. So high-speed photography kind of leads us into this. High-speed photography is all about trying to capture an image of something that's moving at an incredible speed, something that is moving so fast that to the naked eye, it may be either a blur or perhaps even, you know, practically invisible because it's going so quickly. But you want to be able to capture that moment in time so that you can see a very distinct image. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a challenge. You have to figure out how are you going to do that. And there are a couple different ways. Perhaps I hesitate to say the easiest way, but perhaps the simplest way is to set up your camera in a perfectly dark room.
Yeah.
And you just leave the shutter open. Because remember, even though the shutter's open, that film, if there's no light, the film's not being exposed. So you've got this film that's just sitting there. Nothing's happening to it. It's not reacting chemically at all because there's no light coming into the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You set up whatever the thing is you want to take a photo of, and then you have it timed out so that the instant that thing happens, there is a flash of light.
Right.
That is up and down in a fraction of a second. And just that fraction of a second is going to be long enough for the light to go through the camera and to expose the film. Then you could advance the frame and do it again. Now, this is a very slow, painstaking process, and it requires an incredible amount of timing. And there are a lot of different ways of setting up a shot so that the light will trigger at the right moment. Some of them are acoustically triggered so that there's a noise, and that noise causes the light to flash, which automatically exposes the film in the camera. You don't have mm-hmm. to do anything to the camera at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're not pushing a button because the camera shutter is already open. It's only after the light is flashed that you have to advance the film so that you can take another photo. Otherwise, you're going to have a double exposure, high speed double exposure on this film,
mm-hmm.
which I think would look really weird. So that's one way you can do it. But of course, if you want to take a high speed photo of something in nature, for example, an example that a lot of people use is a hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause a hummingbird can beat its wings so quickly that with most cameras, if you took a picture of a hummingbird with a standard camera, it's going to look like a bird with two blurs next to it,
mm-hmm.
right? You won't be able to see the wings. But if you use a high speed camera where it's able to move the shutter at a really fast rate and you have a pretty well lit environment,
mm-hmm.
Then you might be able to capture an image of a hummingbird where you've got its wings perhaps in the up or down position, and you can get a really clear look at that bird. But it does require that you have a camera that can move that shutter speed at a really, really fast rate, and that you have high-speed film that's capable of taking light for an incredibly brief exposure time and convert that into an image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, if you're a tech stuff listener normally, that we like to get into the history of things. And I wouldn't necessarily have thought of high-speed photography as – I would have thought it was a more modern – something that was a more modern phenomenon. But really, the history of high-speed photography goes back just about as long as the history of photography itself. The first example that I read about from an article by Lincoln L. Endelman, which was William Henry Fox Talbot's trial, where he basically exposed a piece of the London Times newspaper that was on a wheel that he attached it to. And he was using a wet plate camera, which is basically a piece of glass that's treated with chemicals rather than a film camera.
Interesting. I had never heard of that before.
But it was 1851.
Yeah, I've heard of the camera obscura, which, by the way, you can actually build one of those yourself if you ever wanted to. But I'd never heard of the wet plate camera. That's interesting.
Yep. He and for a flash, he was using Leyden jars, illumination
wow.
from Leyden jars.
This is like the coolest camera ever.
But he used Yes, and cumbersome, because, you know, you don't really take this thing out to go take shots of the family on vacation.
Right. I'm out to the high school football game. Let me carry my Leyden jars and wet plate camera with me.
But
I'm going to need the team's help setting this up.
But he did manage to get a readable photo of the newspaper at a shutter speed of 1/2000th of a second. Well, wow. An exposure speed, let's say that. I'm not sure it actually used a shutter, right. But you also probably remember Edward Muybridge.
I remember the name, yes.
Yes. He had a famous experiment where he had set up a series of cameras to – because there was a challenge. You may have heard of this guy, Leyden – I'm sorry. Yeah. Hold on. I'm sorry. You may have heard of this guy, Leland Stanford.
Ah.
He was the governor of California, and he was that was the challenge, was does a horse pick up all four of its feet when it's running? And he was the one, Muybridge, and a lot of people have seen this series of photos where they proved that the horse was picking up all four of its feet because he had a series of cameras, and the horse was tripping it as it ran by. And so each camera took photos. A different way of doing it, but they captured a series of still photos because as the horse was running by, it took, you know, each camera in turn took a still photo. And when you put them all together, you get essentially slow motion of this horse running.
Yeah.
And yes, it does pick up all of its feet.
We'll get into that in a little bit because, of course, the photography does lead into cinematography. But before we jump into that, I just wanted to mention one other kind, because I did mention burst photography when we were first introducing this podcast, and that that John Fuller, editor extraordinaire, wrote the article on how burst photography works. Burst photography works on a similar principle of high-speed photography. Now, with high-speed photography, you may be talking about taking a single image and then setting up and taking another single image, right?
Right.
I'm pointing my camera at a hummingbird, and I take one photo.
Right. The point of the high-speed photography here is to capture a very accurate still.
Yeah, yeah. Something that's going to be, you know, it's really used a lot in things like sports, you know, trying to capture that dramatic moment where the quarterback is releasing the Hail Mary pass. I'm saying that right, right? Because I don't know anything about football.
Or, you know, the people who absolutely positively have to have that shot of the water balloon after the balloon is broken and the water is still in the balloon shape.
Right. But,
or the apple with the bullet through it.
But clearly this sort of...
that has to happen.
Yeah, this sort of event is, of course, really hard to capture on film, not just because of the nature of the mechanics where, you know, you've got to have a camera with that proper shutter speed and film with that proper photochemical reaction speed. You also have to have insane timing.
Yes.
And even by setting up an automated system where everything's going to happen automatically, you know, as soon as the event happens, it triggers the camera. Even that is really difficult to do. So perhaps what if you could have a camera that could shoot a series of photos in a very short amount of time using that same kind of principle? Well, that's what burst photography is all about. These are cameras that have not just the really fast shutter speed and not just the special film that's going to react quickly to a very brief exposure, but also the ability to advance film rapidly as you're taking photos.
Mm-hmm.
So with a burst photography camera, it's pulling the film through very quickly, and the shutter is opening and closing, causing multiple exposures, but you're not a double exposure because you're, you know, the film's being pulled through as you're doing this, so that you can take a series of photos in a brief amount of time. So like in a second or two, you might take dozens or more photos. And the nice thing about this is that you can point your camera at whatever the event is and just start shooting photos until you're out of film, and you have a better chance of capturing that iconic moment you're after as a photographer.
Yeah. This is one of those times if you haven't really done a lot of work with people who are professional photographers, and you might be going, well, last time I bought film, I only had 24 exposures on a roll. You can buy, you know, if you are interested in doing this, you can buy whole magazines of film and, you know, attach them to the back of your camera where you have a very, very long roll. Or you can, of course, make your own. If you're so inclined and are good in the dark, I used to have to do, actually, I was a newspaper reporter for a couple of years, and you know, we'd have a big roll of film, and we'd load the magazines the cartridges ourselves, and after a while, you get pretty practiced at it. But the first few times, wasted some film. But yeah, I mean, so this is sort of one of those times when digital cameras sort of have an advantage, because now that we have bigger memory cards and better digital photography, the digital cameras are so much easier and more cost effective than film cameras in this regard. But the burst photography is amazing, especially if you are, you know, it allows you to set up and have a much better shot at getting your shot.
Right.
Than just
clicking and hoping that you got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this kind of leads us, like I said, into cinematography,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, using film to capture images in motion where you are going to play it back so that you have the illusion of motion. So remember, film, as in like I'm going to the movies to watch a film, is the illusion of movement. And it works because mm-hmm. we capture lots of images and then we put them in order and we expose our eyeballs to those images in rapid succession, and that creates the illusion of movement.
Mm-hmm.
So the typical film projector will play back film at a rate of around 24 frames per second, which means that every second that passes, you're looking at 24 images.
Yep.
24 photographs, essentially, is what that is. So you're looking at 24 photographs in a row per second. And because of that, it sort of gives this the illusion of the things that you're looking at are really moving. It's not that you're looking at instances that are put together. It's like it feels like a flowing motion that has no real interruption to it.
I think it's interesting to note too that when you're saying 24 frames per second, that's each frame is 1/24th of a second. That
yes.
seems pretty fast.
Yeah.
But in my research on high-speed photography, I saw mentions of 1/8,000th of a second.
Yeah.
Of course, that would take a whole lot of film.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting to note that 1/24th of a second is reasonable enough to give us an idea of motion and to create that illusion for us.
Right. So if you have a projector that's going to play film back at a steady rate – so let's go with the 24 frames per second.
Okay.
But you have a camera that can actually expose film at a variable rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you can start playing with the slow motion or fast sped up motion on film. So if you've ever watched an old movie where, for comic effect usually, characters start moving around really, really quickly. You know, like there's a chase scene and suddenly everyone's running at a speed that doesn't really look natural.
Well, is Yakety Sax playing?
Yakety Sax may very well be playing. And that's enough of that. Before I get sued. And anyway, yeah, so this is playing with taking more images per second and then playing it back at a steady speed. Now, in the old days, the good old days of filmmaking.
I remember those days.
You had cameras that were hand cranked, which meant that you had a cameraman or camera woman, really, camera person, turning a crank that
squirrels.
Was squirrels, possibly turning a crank at hopefully a fairly consistent speed for normal filming to advance the film through the camera as it's being exposed to light. And the idea being that you want to turn the camera at a good rate so that when you're projecting it back through the projector, it's a steady, smooth experience.
Ready when you are, DB.
So yeah, so this camera is not automated. It's man powered, right?
Yep. And people are known to be, you know, imperfect.
Yeah, not terribly consistent sometimes. So yeah, if you turned the crank faster than normal, you'd be exposing more film in the same amount of time than you would if you were going at your normal rate. And when you're playing it back, remember you're playing it back at a fixed rate. So
right.
If you've captured more images in that amount of time than normal, then you get the effect of slow motion.
Right.
Because while you've captured maybe, say, you know, 48 images, and then so you're looking at 48 images over the space of two seconds. If it were played back at normal speed, now you're looking at it at 1 second. Well, everything starts to slow down.
That could be distracting.
Yeah. So this is that's over cranking.
Yes.
It's when you're cranking the camera faster than the projection playback speed. And there's also under cranking, where you turn the crank slower than the projection speed. This causes a sort of the herky jerky fast motion stuff that you see, especially in older films, mm-hmm. where people are moving faster than they normally could, and often it looks a little jumpy because you're missing information. Right? The more amount of time you have between when two images are taken for something that's in motion, the less natural it's going to look when you're playing it back.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause so if I took a picture of Chris right now and then 3 seconds later took another picture and 3 seconds later took another picture until I had, 200 photos and I played them back at a regular speed, where it would look really, really jerky. You know, it wouldn't look natural at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And jerky, not just because of the subject matter. Ba-dum-bum. So
it's only because I've been dried and cured.
All right. So you may have heard of the term of speed ramping. Speed ramping is when you in the good old days, it was done by accident. But today we do it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Speed ramping is when you change the capture rate of the film or video
mm-hmm.
during a shoot. And this is where you get those weird effects where, like, it's often done in action sequences. For example, let's say it's a fist fight between two characters, and it starts out normal, and one character starts to throw a punch, and just as the character's throwing a punch, it switches so it goes into slow motion. And then just as the punch makes contact with the other person, it speeds up again.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the capture rate, but the playback rate remains constant. That's what we call speed ramping. And there are certain directors who are infamous for speed ramping. If you ever have seen the movie 300 or Watchmen, you know one of the ones I'm talking about. He uses speed ramping so much that it's distracting at times for some people. Other people love it. I personally think a little goes a long way.
I'm sorry, what?
Anyway, they're all based on the same principle. The fact that if you keep the playback rate steady and you change the capture rate, you can make film appear to move slower or faster. Now, you could also play with the playback rate.
Mm-hmm.
If you kept the capture rate the same and you changed the playback rate, you would get the same effect, right? You would either try and display more images per second or fewer images per second than normal, and you could get the same effect. This is a lot easier to do in video than it is in film.
Sure, sure. But it's funny to note, again, that like so many other things in photography, that the key to slow motion is high-speed photography.
Yeah.
To really get an idea of what's happening and slow it down, you have to capture many images so that you can go from image to image at a slower rate and really get a good idea of the motion and how things are transpiring in that image.
Yeah. Yeah. If you take a video of something or a film of something and it's at 8,000 frames per second and you play it back on a 24 frames per second projector, it's going to take you a long time to get through. Like, even if you only shot for maybe 5 seconds, that's going to take you a long time to get through those 5 seconds when you're playing it back at a rate of 24 frames per second. So then you get this incredible slow motion effect where at times it may look like nothing is even moving because everything is, you're capturing such tiny moments of time that it's hard for us to detect changes until they are dramatic changes. And this is where you can see some of those really cool effects where, like Chris was saying, the water balloon, where you pop the balloon and the water has retained the balloon shape for a couple of split seconds, like moments in time. And then you start to see it, of course, fall. We've seen some really cool footage because of this technique.
And you can too. If you go to the HowStuffWorks.com site, we have a lot of clips from the Discovery show Time Warp.
Yeah.
Which was really popular a couple years ago because it showed extreme slow motion.
Yeah, using amazing high definition slow motion cameras that are taking thousands of frames of footage per second. And then playing it back at normal speed.
Yeah. And it's just, it's absolutely amazing. I can watch them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, even the ones I've seen before, you know, I can go back and watch them just because it's so fascinating how well that works.
I love the ones where people get slapped and you just see the face deform.
Oh, yeah.
Slowly.
Yeah.
Wow. That's what happens whenever I say anything to anyone. That's insane. I'm constantly, my face is hurting. Yeah. I got slapped just before this podcast, actually.
Yeah, but it was you that did it.
That's true.
Anyhow.
I never said that it was necessarily caused by someone else.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, you can see that right now. They're still up there. And I think when we post this, we'll probably, I'm pretty sure there's a playlist we can show people.
But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a lot of fun to do that. And it's a lot of fun to fool around with high speed photography just as a, you know, just as somebody who is a hobbyist.
Yeah.
To see what you can do with it. And
now granted, if you want to get like a really good high speed camera, this can be an expensive hobby.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about a top of the line, kind of setup, then you're looking at thousands of dollars. So it's not a cheap hobby necessarily, but it is really, it's really cool.
No. And then, you know, if you're really staging things too.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, then I've got the whole staging costs and stuff.
Yeah. And you're starting to talk about again, because it is a matter of the camera detecting the image and getting synchronized with the event that you're trying to photograph.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you have to buy the equipment to do that. We were talking about sound equipment. There are setups that require, you know, that the sound will cause the camera to fire, and you know this is
yeah.
Again, you're having to buy more gear, but it's fun if you can afford it.
It's pretty interesting stuff. So yeah, this wraps up our discussion about high speed photography, slow motion cameras in general, film. Stuff is really, really interesting. In fact, so interesting to me that when I look at the complexity of these devices, I mean, the principle is pretty simple from a high concept point of view. But when I start looking at the ingenuity that was required to bring a camera into reality, I just, mm-hmm. It's phenomenal to me. Again, it's one of those things where we take it for granted now because they're everywhere. I mean, we have cameras incorporated into practically every mobile device you could think of, but the principles behind it, I mean, it's just phenomenal. Amazing that we figured this out.
Yeah. I mean,
I mean people way smarter than I am.
Well, you think about how the difference in the early cameras, the, you know, daguerreotypes and the wet plate type devices versus the tiny little cameras in our smartphones
yeah.
and, you know, shoes and everything else.
Yes. I don't want any shoe cameras. Let's not do that, okay?
All right.
Shoe people out there, don't put cameras in your shoes.
How about diamonds on the soles of your shoes?
How about self-lacing shoes? Hey, they just came out with those.
Yeah, well.
All right, anyway, we're going to wrap this up. So, guys, if you have any topics you would like us to talk about, please let us know. You can let us know through email. Our address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is techstuffhsw. Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.